This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
As a guy who learned the hard way how important proper nutrition is on your health and the great harm excess weight can have on your health, I urge you to get serious about your health with SimpleToLose.com. Diets don't work, and you're really only going to be successful losing weight when you learn how to eat differently. And that is why the free health coaches at Simple to Lose are so helpful. They teach you how to eat six meals a day and why it works. Many people on my team are working with Simple to Lose and their health coaches. As a team, we've lost over 850 pounds. Mary has lost over 85 pounds and wants to live a long life to keep her family strong. Brad's lost 40 pounds, finally feels like he did when he was in his 30s. Chris, whose father died young due to obesity, has lost 100 pounds and is off most of his medications. Change your life, get healthy, and thrive today. Go to SimpleToLose.com today, not tomorrow. Go today. SimpleToLose.com.
Results do vary. Typical weight loss is 2 to 5 pounds per week for the first 2 weeks, then 1 to 2 pounds per week thereafter.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you so much for joining. Broad voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. So I promise you I wouldn't waste a lot of your time on excessive political coverage, because you're going to get that everywhere else you turn. Everywhere else you look, it's very likely that you'll be hearing a lot of, oh, look what this poll says, and oh, the latest here on the swing voter, on the undecideds, and oh gosh, people who just want to be informed about the world are going to have to often be satisfied with only being informed about the world of Hillary Clinton and some others. That's very likely to happen. That's what's going to happen. But it's very early still in all of this. It's early enough that we don't even know. It's conceivable that there'll be someone who decides to poke his or her head out and try to at least give Hillary not a run for her money. She's got a lot of money, but to give some semblance of some pretense, at least of competition, they'll pretend. You know, they will come out and they'll do something from, oh, I don't know. Usually, I would guess from the left, but who knows? There could be some candidates that don't really represent much of anything who may come out against Hillary. The campaign, from the political perspective, is not yet in full swing, and already, I think some people are kind of tired of the absolutely saturated coverage of the very few issues of substance that have come out. The substance stuff has been minimal, particularly from the Clinton campaign. I know that there was an explainer of sorts from Marco Rubio and Mike Lee about the tax plan. So there's some on the Republican side that are actually talking substance. But what's fascinating on the Clinton side of the campaign is just how completely insane everything has been so far, how ridiculous, preposterous, utterly worthy of mockery so much of what we've seen has been. Now, you've got this woman, let's just recap for a second, who is among the most famous political figures in the country, among the probably three or four, and you could probably say she's number two, really, after Barack Obama. Although Bill Clinton is still really famous, even though he hasn't been in the game technically in a while. But there's no doubt about the fact that Hillary is obviously the elite of the elites, and that she's the ultimate insider, and she's become vastly wealthy, finding different ways to peddle influence, really. I mean, that's what this is all about. I know there's at least the make-believe notion that this is because Hillary is such a dedicated public servant. Well, somehow her main job is to run a global charity, and she simultaneously becomes worth $100 million, right? That's a bit strange, isn't it? Well, her husband's helping, I guess you could say, but people are not paying you $300,000 a speech because they think you're such a good orator, Hillary. I think we all know that. And so that creates problems, though, because we already know this stuff. There's a pretty clear distinction between what it was like when Barack Obama was running in 2008 and Hillary now. Barack could be whatever the media wanted him to be, and they wanted him to be, and they convinced enough Americans to get him elected that Barack was like a post-partisan superhero, a messianic figure of sorts, somebody who could come and heal all of our ills as a country and who would stop the rise of the seas and yada, yada. You know the rest of all that stuff. That was the Barack candidacy. And then in the second time around, it was, well, you can either sort of fulfill the promise of Barack Obama as a candidate and give him two terms, or you can vote for the mean rich guy. Now you see the mean rich gal is Hillary, and everyone already knows it. And the campaign that has come out has been bereft of substance, right? It's not clear what Hillary Clinton believes or is going to do yet, and that will change over time. But for now, it's just been a giant exercise in the vapid, in platitudes, saying vague stuff that sounds good. Yeah, I like middle class and America and ice cream. That's been essentially the extent of the intellectual exertion from Hillary's campaign so far. But then you get into the little stuff, the day-to-day nitty-gritty. For example, they're driving around in a Scooby-Doo van.
Scooby?
They're driving around in a van it's called the Scooby van, and it's a big armored vehicle that is sort of part van, part SUV. And the whole point here is that Hillary's going around Iowa, and she's doing the sort of retail politician stuff that she failed to do well enough. Remember, not just Barack Obama, but John Edwards. The super slimy John Edwards also beat her in Iowa in 2008, which says a lot about Democrats, by the way. I want to meet the Democrats that thought that John Edwards was a leader, somebody that, a visionary, who could take us into the future, who could command the world's most powerful military effectively. But that's a bit of a diversion. So Hillary's going around in this van, and what we see is every day. Now, look, the coverage is absolutely insane. They couldn't spend any more time and effort, it seems, following her every move. And reporters are already receiving some mockery of their own because a Scooby van will pull up, and they all run like a bunch of teenage girls seeing the Beatles for the first time or something. They completely lose their minds. Like, oh, it's Hillary, and they start running towards her. They see the Scooby van, and everyone gets all excited. And then we find out more stuff. And we start to feel a little weird about this. And people perhaps aren't paying very close attention right now, particularly the undecideds that are going to be the ones who make or break the Clinton campaign at the polls. But if you do pay attention just a little bit, you start seeing some things. You think, wow, this is the best they can do. This is what they've got at this point in time. Is that really the case? For example, Hillary coming out and saying that her grandparents were immigrants and how she's always been speaking about her grandparents' immigrant experience. And sure enough, with a little bit of quick digging, at least one of her grandparents was born here in the early 1880s. So that was one thing. Hillary's grandmother was born shortly after her parents and siblings arrived in the U.S. In the 1880s. That's the latest on that. You say, well, that's kind of a minor thing. And okay, fine. And people say this stuff. And at least she didn't say that she's Native American because of her cheekbones, as her possible competition at one point said. Never mind the fact that she used that to very much push a narrative that helped her professionally in all sorts of ways. But nonetheless, there we have it. We have Hillary essentially coming out and saying all this stuff, and it's not true, and that's just, we're supposed to say, not a big deal. Then she goes into a campaign stop. She goes into a campaign stop, and she finds herself, sitting down with just your average Iowans, just having a chat. Hillary rolling up the sleeves of the pantsuit, trying to be pals and buds with whoever happens to be there. And it then comes out that she actually sits down with a, quote, healthcare lobbyist in training who was an Obama campaign intern and a Biden chauffeur. So they've picked out a bunch of Democrat volunteers and operatives to sit down for a completely staged coffee shop talk. And this just goes to show you again, everything is hypermanaged. Everything is, even with the defense of the media, understand that too. This isn't Sarah Palin, who no matter what she does is going to be ridiculed and laughed at and mocked, and the media is going to find something. I mean, the media debased themselves in their coverage of Sarah Palin as a vice presidential candidate as much as they did in their cheerleading for Barack Obama. But this is Hillary. all the major media outlets, all the aging boomer journalists out there, they're all in the tank for Hillary. We know that. So what's she so afraid of? You start to get that sense. Her campaign, her handlers, all the rest of them, they're afraid that people will actually see who Hillary Clinton is, that they'll be exposed to her in a moment that is honest and that is real. And they'll say, this is not somebody that I can identify with. This is somebody who's actually talking down to me, down to us. And that's it. Because as you know, all the policy in the world can't change people's voting habits if they decide that they don't like you. And it goes to these terms you'll hear the strategists and the pundits say, like likability. Well, it's not just likability with Hillary, it's believability. Here's somebody who's running on already talking about campaign finance reform while she simultaneously plans on raising $2 billion for her campaign. She couldn't be any more connected. She couldn't have any more to gain from very well-moneyed interests that are trying to push parts of her agenda. But she talks about that like she really, really believes it. It just seems so very incredibly fake. But everything about this is starting to look more and more fake. Now, I should say that there are some things that she receives a bit of criticism for. The whole Chipotle stop where she went people said incognito burrito. She wanted to get a Chipotle burrito and she wasn't noticed. And all of this, again, very staged. She was like, oh, well, she didn't tip. I've been to Chipotle. I'll be honest with you. I'm not aware that people generally tip at a Chipotle, but maybe they do in some Chipotles, but that's not, I don't think that's a particularly fair criticism. So I don't want to go to that point where people are going after what's being done for this campaign in such a way that you see that it's just partisan and it's petty and it's nonsense. But already you're starting to get a sense that this whole thing is going to require a really strong effort to keep together. There's going to have to be a lot of media help because you have this woman who's going around who is really trying to fight against what she is and who she is, at least on policy issues, and convince people that somehow there's no problem with the enormous hypocrisy. There's no problem with the fact that now the Clinton Foundation has said that they're going to continue to accept money from foreign donors. I really think at this point, the Clinton position on a lot of this stuff is, what are you going to do without us? Who, if not us, will be the Democrat nominee? And I say the us purposefully there, Bill and Hillary, because you know it's a twofer, it's a double deal. And they know that the whole machinery, all the Democrat Party, everything has to get behind them, so it doesn't really matter what they do. They just have to go through the motions here and hope that they're propelled across the finish line and keep enriching themselves and keep their power. See, the Clintons have one thing. The one thing they're sure of is that they are going to be a huge dynasty, power brokers. No matter what happens in this election, they're going to be the Clintons. And by the way, don't think that they're not already at least considering the idea of the next generation of Clinton running for some form of higher elected office. They're going to keep accepting money from foreign donors, even though we know that could be an issue for them in the campaign, but it won't be enough of an issue because the media is not going to make a big issue out of it. And we're supposed to think that it's normal that, for example, they say that any foreign government can send a participant to one of these Clinton Global Initiative panels or this big bloated thing that they have that apparently is just saving the world, right? Anyone from any government can pay $20,000 as an attendance fee to join a Clinton Global Initiative meeting. So you're paying $20,000 to sit in some boring meeting. I don't think that people are paying that price tag just because they're so concerned with women's empowerment around the world. And certainly the Clinton Global Initiative can't be that concerned with it, considering that they'll take money from countries that don't care about women's rights at all. In fact, work aggressively to oppress females. So here we are now. Already, it's been a week, and part of me feels like this is too much. There's too much coverage. But what you see is just sort of minor stumble after stumble, and just the whole thing looks gross and disingenuous and kind of slimy and off-putting. And we're going to be in for this for another year and a half. It's kind of amazing when you think about it, but that's the way it's going to be. just get ready. They're already thinking about what the Clinton campaign 2.0 iteration and 3.0, they're going to have to shift, because there's no way they can just keep up with this talk and this meet and these meetings and all this stuff they're doing that just seems so utterly phony. It just feels and looks phony. And even people who don't care about politics can pick that up. Back in a minute.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Are you looking to save 50, 60, even 70% on your phone bill? Well, here's a tip. Broadvoice.com. Hi, it's Brad Staggs of Blaze TV here. Broadvoice offers high-quality phone service for only $8.95 a month. You may ask, how can I save so much money? What's the catch? Well, the secret is the technology. Broadvoice uses VoIP technology that takes analog audio signals from your phone, turns them into digital data, and then transfers them over the Internet. This means crystal clear sound and cheaper phone bills. Broadvoice has been ranked in the Deloitte Technology Fast 500 and Inc. 500 as one of the fastest-growing private companies in America. Get Broadvoice right now for only $8.95 a month. Keep your existing phone number for free, and Broadvoice will send you their easy plug-in adapter free. All this, and you get unlimited local calling for just $8.95 a month. Plus, for a limited time, Broadvoice will even give you your first month free. Do what we did here at Blaze Radio. Make the switch today at broadvoice.com or call 888-332-8036. 888-332-8036.
Buck Sexton.
There's some real problems that are brewing when it comes to the anti-police movement in this country. Not a ton of media coverage of it because they haven't grown that much in size just yet. And I also think that there's a moment of a sort of gathering together of the various factions that want to make a big statement about police violence across the country. Interesting that given some of the incidents that we've seen in recent weeks, and they have been bad. And this is nothing new because police make mistakes and police can go bad. In fact, the NYPD, they used to refer to perps in uniform as part of training. They would talk about people who, just because they have a badge and a gun, doesn't mean they're not a criminal. And they were always on the lookout for that. And it was the duty of other sworn law enforcement officers to immediately hold those who would break the law while in uniform accountable for it. That was part of the training. That was something that would be openly talked about. But some of these incidents that we've seen are bad. Some of them certainly seem to deserve criminal prosecution. In one case, very obviously so. And in others, it seems like negligence was certainly the case. And then we start to see that there's also the possibility that there's been some structural issues with this, shall we call it, I guess. For example, that situation in Tulsa, where the cop thought he was going for his taser and, in fact, went for a revolver and then shot a man who was already on the ground and being handcuffed. That was a 73-year-old reserve deputy named Robert Bates. Well, now there are some saying that he never received the certifications needed. There are some reports, I should say, that he didn't receive the certifications that he needed to be carrying or using that weapon in the pursuance of his reserve deputy duties. Again, here in New York City, there's the auxiliary police, and they basically got a baton, maybe. They have radios. They're really the equivalent of a neighborhood watch that has a direct line into the cops. They're not armed the way that police officers are. They don't have pistols, and they definitely don't have tasers, and they walk around, and they're essentially just extra eyes. Sheriff's deputies apparently can be armed and trained and treated quite the same way as sworn professional law enforcement. So they've got to be very careful. The moment you start giving people a loaded weapon and saying you need to be able to use this as part of your duties, the training becomes essential. And if there was a lack of training here, and there are some that are saying that not only was there a lack of training, there was a cover-up of it, and that they just allowed this 73-year-old man to have a firearm that he was not trained to use on duty, then we've got a big problem. So you see these things bubbling up across the country, and there have been some pretty substantial protests in the same places as we usually expected, because the activists know where their support base is, and they also know where it's easiest for them to organize. So you've got protests in Oakland, protests in San Francisco, and protests here in New York City. In fact, just earlier this week, they shut down the Brooklyn Bridge for a little while by walking across it. And there were some incidents where cops were, in fact, assaulted. They were attacked because they were cops. And in one case, an officer was punched in the face. Now, this takes time for the real mobilization to occur. But I think what you're seeing here is, once again, the machinery, the sort of anti-cop machinery, is going to get going in a nationwide fashion. I think you're going to see the protests start to ramp up. And I think that they're just trying to figure out which incident, because there have been a few, which incident they will most clearly rally around. Now, you would think that South Carolina would be the obvious choice for mobilization purposes, because you have an individual who was shot. There's a video. It's horrific. And already murder charges have been pressed. I think that's the one that's most likely. But you also have to wonder, to what end? Because the activists are the ones who push the protests. I'm not talking about social media and that sort of thing. I mean, what gets people out on the street? What gets people throwing rocks and screaming at police? And what's the purpose of that? There have to be individuals who are bringing all of that together. And I think that you may see that there are some headwinds against it, because in this coming election year, make no mistake about it, the Democrat Party is still very tied in with many of these far-left institutions, many of these community organizer outfits and activists. And they're going to have to find a way to position themselves, because they have a lot of material to work with here, such that they can cause trouble, but it is not blamed on Hillary, the Democrats, and the Democratic establishment. But just wait. These anti-cop issues are going to be more.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
Broad voice lines are open. 888-900-3393 is where you can give a call. Please do. Also, you can go to facebook.com/Buck Sexton. Like the page. You can share thoughts and comments there with all the other Team Buck peeps. And you can go to bucksexton.com, and you can start to check out pieces there and all the rest of it. All right. So, talking before about how the sort of the activists, right, because they're going to have to fall in line behind the Clinton banner. I think they were very excited. Anyone who calls himself an activist or a community organizer, for obvious reasons, is pretty excited about the prospect of an Obama presidency. And so that wasn't a hard thing. And they were all working towards the same goal of getting Barack Obama elected, not once, but twice. Clinton is seen as being more of a, establishment politician by, and obviously doesn't have quite the same inspiring personal story that Barack Obama did for the left and for many others. And so they're going to have to find a way to be supportive and part of the whole, part of the team, so to speak. They're going to have to get on board for all this stuff. And that's going to require a degree of discipline. And that's, I think that this sort of thinking does filter in even to, well, cop protests. I mean, do people want to be, what will be helpful for the Clinton campaign going forward? Do we want big protests in the streets, or is that going to look like we're getting away from law and order and maybe Clinton's a little too sympathetic? Or I don't know. I mean, it'll be on a sort of a case-by-case basis. But one thing I do know is that party discipline is going to be everything, because Clinton's going to need the whole machine behind her and pushing for her, right? She can count on, if you've been in journalism for 20 years or more, got to be a 90-95% chance you're a Clintonite, right? You just love the Clintons. And she can count on that, and she can count on the sort of diehard Democrat voters, the Democrat base, to go with her no matter what. And I think that actually the Clintons are going to be sort of abusive of their base in the sense that they can look at them and say, there is no alternative. What you going to do? You know, this is sort of like what happens when with some Mideast dictators in the United States. We say, hey, you know, Hosni, can you calm down with the torturing people in the prisons and the repression and the one-party rule? And he's like, whoa, hold on a second there, buddy. It's me or the crazy jihadist people that want to do death to America. So why don't you step off? And the Clintons will have a different, but in broad strokes, similar dynamic with the Democratic Party. Democrats may say, hey, Hillary, can you not be sort of so grasping and gross and self-dealing all the time? Some Democrats may say that, although they'll do it quietly. And she'll probably look them in the eye and say, I don't think so. It's going to be Hillary's way. What are you going to do about it? And she's right. There's no alternative. There's no other option. So she has all the power in all this. But the issue of discipline, this is going to become an important one. And I think that we have to tie this into, at least give some thought to the possibility that that's what's going on with this Senator Bob Menendez indictment. Now, as you know, Menendez faces federal indictment on a variety of corruption and honest services fraud charges. And there's a piece today in the Wall Street Journal that I think is very apt. It's very insightful because it starts to say, all right, let's look at what these charges actually are. Let's look at what supposedly happened here. First of all, this investigation took 3 years. 3 year investigation? Okay. They already had the facts. Maybe that's true. Maybe it can take 3 years, but seems a little suspicious. And the timing of it, as you know, is suspicious to many because Menendez has been an outspoken critic of Obama's sort of kind of maybe in the future at some point Iran deal. So this starts to, I think, get to that issue, right? Menendez is now indicted. But there's an even bigger problem than whether this is just trying to keep the Democrat troops in line. There's a bigger issue than just that. Because when you look at these charges, we live in a society now where the Justice Department essentially gets to determine what qualifies as corruption. And as I've said to you so many times before, that mens rea, did you mean for this to be an illegal exchange of something tangible for something valuable in terms of your official duties? That doesn't really even factor into the Justice Department can just make the case. I mean, he's facing 14 counts of corruption and honest services fraud for intervening on behalf of a constituent and constituencies that give money to his campaign. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that what political donations are all about, by the way? I mean, are we really that delusional? Are we really going to pretend that people aren't sending money to Capitol Hill, aren't sending money to all these different PACs and political donation machines for some, because there's no self-interest involved in this. It's just I just support the ideas. Yeah, right. This is complete crap and everyone knows it. So when is and this goes back to 2010 when they adjusted honest services fraud, because, as was pointed out by Justice Scalia, honest services fraud as written as federal statute could mean that a politician could be guilty of felony honest services fraud for accepting a good table at a restaurant. Oh, maybe you're now in the pocket of the restaurant industry. I mean, it just was completely out of control. And and the Justice Department went after Conrad Black, for example, under honest services fraud. And I think it was the same headhunting jerk scum. What was his name? Fitzgerald, who went after Scooter Libby and the whole Valerie Plame thing. I think that was him as well with going after Conrad Black, which was a complete joke. And the Supreme Court, by the way, ended up overturning part of that conviction as unconstitutional because it was just an open license. Remember, a lot of these powerful lawyers in the Justice Department, which is all they are, a lot of these powerful lawyers that work for DOJ have their own aspirations. They want to get their name out there. They want people to know who they are because then, a la Fitzgerald, they get to go to some fancy law firm and get paid a ton of money when they're done with their little bit of government service. Even if they don't want to be elected politicians and make their way up that side of the ranks, they still want to be known. They still want high profile cases. And there are few things more high profile than public corruption. So there's a huge incentive, irrespective of party, to go after people under these sort of very vague charges. Because it's just getting to the point where it's completely ridiculous. I can't distinguish between. And this is what happened with Bob McDonnell as well. If something looks gross, is it illegal? If there's a quid pro quo, something for something, if that's the case, then there has to be a quo, right? There has to be a real exchange of something that's very clear and for that reason. By the way, there was a meeting, as the Wall Street Journal points out, in which they list Senator number 3, and that senator was Harry Reid. Harry Reid was at a sit-down along with Dr. Melgen, who's the individual who's now facing not just sort of the bribery Menendez charges, but also huge Medicare fraud charges. And Harry Reid was also at one of these meetings, but you'll see no charges have been brought against Dirty Harry. They're just letting him go forth and do the usual Harry Reid stuff. So if it was so illegal for Melgen to sit down at this meeting and donate money, by the way, he also donated money to Harry, to a PAC that was involved with Harry Reid's campaign fund, Majority PAC. So wouldn't he also then be guilty? He's getting money and he's intervening on behalf of this guy. So why isn't he facing huge prosecution from the federal government for this? As the Wall Street Journal says, if we're going to slip down this slope, should Democrats who take money from the trial bar and then vote to make it easier to file class action lawsuits go to jail? By this standard, Hillary should be rung up for the foreign donations the Clinton Foundation accepted while she was Secretary of State, and senators should serve time for recommending donors' kids for military academies. Yeah, that's right. Any favor done for anyone could be considered corruption and a crime under the current reading of statute that these public officials... And you'd say, well, why don't all of them get prosecuted? Ah! Therein we get to the truth. Because it all comes down to political connections. It's just politics. It's not law. Depends on who the machinery wants to eat up at any point in time. Money and speech go together in our society. And the idea that you can decide with a very open-ended statute that corruption only applies in some cases, but not others, based upon whatever the whims are of some bureaucrat in the Department of Justice. This is terrifying. You could make the case that basically every politician now, some of you are probably going to stand up and cheer. You could make the case that under statute right now, more or less every politician in D.C. is a felon. I can hear the clapping, but we don't actually think that it would be a good idea to throw. Well, generally speaking, we don't think it would be a good idea to throw all politicians in prison for doing what they do. We wouldn't have anyone left to. Well, I know now I'm starting to think this is a good idea, too, but you know where I'm going with this. It is astonishing. It is astonishing. And Menendez, by the way, just one more point on this. He is not somebody who has leveraged his time in office into vast personal enrichment, whereas Harry Reid has. Harry Reid's become a wealthy guy while he's been a senator, but we're paying his salary. We know what it is. How is he wealthy exactly? How is he living in the Ritz-Carlton in D.C.? Oh, but no. He's going to prison, they say. They want to send him to jail. Could this be about enforcing discipline within the Democratic Party? Is that why DOJ got the green light from Eric Holder to go after Senator Menendez and not Harry Reid? Maybe not, but someone's got to explain to me what the difference is.
Buck Sexton will be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network. This is The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, to anyone paying attention these days, raising awareness has become a much abused concept. It's now become a catch-all for any number of ways to get yourself out of a false accusation or jumping on a bandwagon before the facts are in or creating a narrative that's just untrue. So people will say, well, I was just raising awareness. You say, well, in that case, I guess everything's fine because you were raising awareness, which is really important. And this is, I think, another instance of that. And as we see, and this is a more minor one, except you've got to be careful when you start throwing around accusations about individuals. There's a comedian named Sarah Silverman. I am not a fan, which is fine. I am entitled to not be a fan. I do not find her funny at all. Never have, but that's okay. There are comedians who are mainstream and leftist that I do think are really funny. We're not going to discuss them right now. I don't think Sarah Silverman's funny, never have. But anyway, that's really neither here nor there for the purposes of what we're about to talk about. She gave a public service announcement where she told the story about how, you know, wage gap, women not paid as much as men, discrimination, terrible, terrible. Play the beginning of that for me, will you, Stephen?
I was doing stand-up, you know, just around the town, and I did a show. I was out with my friend Todd Barry, and we were doing sets around town together. And, you know, I was pretty well-known already, and we both did back-to-back 15-minute sets at this club, the New York Comedy Club. And he paid me $10, and it was a Saturday night. I didn't think anything of it, you know. And we were outside talking, and Todd somehow brought up that he, you know, mentioned that he got $60. He just got $60, and I just got $10. We did the exact same time, back-to-back, on the same show. And so I went back inside, and I asked the owner, Al Martin, and I said, Al, why did you pay me $10 and you gave Todd Barry $60? And he, you know, it was so perfect because it goes up. Oh, did you want a $60 spot?
Yeah, it's a great story, except for the fact that it's not true. Now, you could say this is sort of a minor thing, and it is. Look, this is not ruining anyone's reputation or life. Let's keep this in the proper context. It's not a huge deal, but it's indicative of a mindset, which is that people now increasingly are willing to go out and tell these stories. They feel very safe telling stories with a certain narrative, even if the facts don't line up. By the way, the facts in this case with this unfunny comedian were that the individual who didn't pay her the same amount of money, it's because the guy who went before her was officially booked. She just sort of dropped in. This would be like, as I do sometimes at other places and have done, you know, you can show up and do a news hit somewhere and you're their guest. They don't pay you. That's not a wage gap issue for anybody. You're just not paid. And you know that going in. Other people are on contract and they're paid. So she wasn't somebody who was booked and therefore wasn't promised a certain payment. In fact, the only reason we know this is the truth is because the club owner, who was called out by name and did not appreciate that because he has a reputation too, and Sarah Silverman has admitted that that was definitely a mistake. And the second you're going to start naming names, you better have the facts straight. And she didn't. But the whole issue of the wage gap here comes up when, and he says that this is not true. And he says that he accepts her apology and that's all fine. Okay. You know what? We could wash our hands of this and say, all right, what's the big deal? Why is it a big deal? It's because it is yet another instance. It's just indicative of a mindset. Now, this is a minor incident in that mindset, to be sure. But it's part of the broader theme that we've been seeing, which is that people tell stories, people lie about things, journalists go along with things because there's a narrative, because they're trying to make some broader point about things. And this is why, for example, even when you look at the UVA rape hoax aftermath with Columbia Journalism School looking into it, there's still this conception of, well, they still don't know what happened that night to the false accuser in this case. They still don't know. They're still clinging to this narrative, and they still want to talk about sexual assault on campus. It's like, well, the facts have to be primary in any discussion, or else what are we even doing here? Just because you have a theme, or you got a narrative, or you have a story you want to tell, doesn't mean you're supposed to make stuff up, particularly when it can injure somebody's reputation. In this case, it was minor. In UBA's case, it was massive. Same mentality, though. I think we need to call that out. Put a stop to it.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck, thank you for staying with me into hour two of the show today. Broad voice lines are wide open, 888-900-3393. Please call in. Anything you want to talk about, fair game today. This is not really a dominant story in the news cycle, which is good. It means there's plenty of room for us to run, do whatever we want in terms of analysis, discussion, you name it. But first, we have a special guest, a first-time guest on the show. We have Adele Nazarian joining us. She's a reporter for Breitbart News, Breitbart.com. Adele, thank you for calling in. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Buck. Great to be on. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, Iran obviously has gotten a lot of attention recently in the news because of the sort of deal that might be a future deal, but we don't really know. And then, of course, there's what's in it, which we also don't know because they think one thing, we think another. What do you think about where it all stands right now? I mean, I know that Iran is something that you cover. In fact, your family is Iranian, correct?
Yes. I was born in America. My parents were born in Iran. They came here. They immigrated here at a very young age. And you're absolutely correct in saying that the framework right now is very it's very inclusive, and both countries, America and Iran, are talking past each other. And what we have here is, I mean, the June 30th deadline fastly approaching, and I don't really know that it's going to pan out the way that the current administration planned on having it pan out, and it's going to be much the disappointment of the Iranian regime.
What about the Iranian people? I saw a piece that you wrote on Breitbart about this. You know, there was all the celebration and such. Their support for a nuclear Iran, but not necessarily a nuclear armed Iran. Or where does the population come into this in terms of what they think should happen? The Iranian population, what would they like to see?
This is there's a tremendous dichotomy here with the media's portrayal and coverage of this, because you have the majority of Iranians that are really not for the regime. They are so hopeless and so hopeful in that same exact regard of having some kind of getting back at zero again, having just some semblance to life where they can work, have enough money to be able to provide them food and nourishment for themselves, that they see, a small majority see this as being, you know, a glimmer of hope for them for the future. Now, what the media did not cover is the fact that, you know, you have these Iranians who are in the street kind of celebrating this framework deal, but then you have counter-protests going on with a big group that actually are opposed to all the celebrations, because they know that what this is going to do, should the Iranian regime get, you know, $150 billion potentially in frozen assets released back to them, it's only going to solidify their longevity. It will essentially crush any hope for the people to rise up again and to, you know, elect a democratically elected form of government and have some sort of semblance to, you know, life that's not under a Sharia law that is keeping them down and has rampant human rights abuses.
Is there any doubt in your mind that the mullahs want to get nuclear weapons, not just nuclear capability and power, but actual nuclear weapons? I mean, is that, where would you put your certainty on that scale?
I'd have to say, on a scale of 1 to 10, now I've heard very conflicting views from people who are actually in with the regime and who are the general population. I'd say on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say it's about a 10 to an 11. All you have to do is really look to history to see that Ruhollah Khomeini, who was the founder of the Islamic regime in Iran, he had penned a letter in 1988 which called outright for nuclear weapons. And that letter was released in 2006. The Iranian media scrambled to delete the nuclear weapon reference from it. But, you know, today you have what I like to call a false fatwa. You have even President Barack Obama claiming that Khomeini, who is the current Islamic supreme leader, has said that Iran will not acquire nuclear weapons. He never said that. A fatwa was never issued. Even if it was, you know, why isn't there proof, tangible proof of it existing? So even if there was a religious edict, which is a fatwa, that Iran would not acquire nuclear weapons, Khomeini, who was the predecessor to Khamenei, his word reigns supreme over the current Islamic leaders. And he calls right out for nuclear weapons. So I don't doubt it whatsoever. And you have to look at Iran's relationship with Russia. Russia on Monday, they lifted an embargo to sell, I think, S-300
missiles. Yes.
Exactly, missiles to Iran. That's very telling. That's a complete violation to their treaty and to America's rules, actually, and to the UN's, I believe. And what it's doing is essentially defying the Obama administration and also causing for you know, for Putin to kind of directly call out Israel and pushing them to get closer to possibly bombing Iran. And, you know, we're going to see that unfold over the next few months. We'll see what happens June 30th, but it's definitely going to, at the least, set off a nuclear arms race in the Middle East if Iran does get, A, closer to acquiring that lump sum of $150 billion, and if their collusion with Russia is taken to a different level.
What are you working on this week, Adele? Anything coming out that we could tell people to keep an eye out for in Breitbart?
Definitely. Thank you so much. I am actually working on an exclusive story. It will be a world exclusive of an image which shows Iran's terrorist activities with shuffling terrorists and militants between Iran and other Middle Eastern countries.
Oh, wow.
So that should be a pretty big story.
And that'll be on Breitbart.com?
Breitbart.com.
All right, excellent. You can follow Adele at Adele with two L's, Nas, on Twitter. Adele, thank you so much for joining us. Good of you to be in the Freedom Hut for the first time. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Buck.
All right. Guys, the Broad Voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. We can talk about whatever you want to talk about. I'm wide open here. Short of that, I think. I don't know, maybe we'll talk Russia. We were just talking Russia for a minute. Could be interesting. Back in a minute, everybody.
Buck Sexton.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
Broad Voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Also, you can send me tweets at Buck Sexton. Please do. And, oh my, there are a few issues where I think you have more of a, there's more of a pressure from a sort of a wanting to look smart, pressure to take a certain position than on anything having to do with global warming, climate change, all that kind of stuff, right? There are a few places where you can go. There are a few areas of politics that seem to be as beset with peer pressure. Really, that's what it is. It's peer pressure. It's a question of whether people are trying to, whether people want to look smart or not. There's some things you want to look cool on, and there's some things you want to look smart on. And if you're in a room full of people who fancy themselves fancy, who think that their degrees mean that they are of a higher intellectual echelon than the rest, right? Though it's a whole separate discussion we could have, and I know that a lot of people have been getting a lot of high schoolers and their parents, of course, are dealing with the either acceptances or rejections from schools, and I would just say to all of them, it's not as big a deal as everyone makes it out to be. It's a product like many other products. It's a necessary step for many people. It's not a completely necessary step for all people, and there's way too much weight put on particularly, you know, there are some things, some places you can go. There are some resume bullets that you'd have from certain schools that would result in perhaps some doors being open. But for the most part now, an undergraduate degree just doesn't have the same clout, the same resonance with employers that it once did, because basically everyone's getting them now. Not everyone, but a large percentage of the country, larger than ever before. And that just means that, of course, now there's, in the arms race, you need more arms. I mean, you need more work experience, or you need an advanced degree or some sort of specialization. And that's just sort of what's happening. So undergraduate work is not the same as it used to be in terms of deciding your life path. It's just true. And I see it with all my friends and colleagues, too. If you get into a great school, fantastic. If you get into a school that, you know, is just OK, or if you're not in love with where you're going to school, well, you can always transfer. You can always go to a better grad program. There's so many options out there. Or you can just find a career path that you really like and just make it happen, which is, you know, sort of going old school on that. But I digress. Back to the climate change stuff. So you're in a room full of smart people and you immediately want to seem smart. You have to say, well, of course, I believe in climate change. Now, I will tell you, I believe in climate change because the climate is changing all the time, and it has changed throughout history, and that's this is like saying, do you believe in, you know, the variability of human existence or something like that? Do you believe that time is constantly passing? And that there, I mean, this is a very weird question to ask someone, actually, when you break it down. Do you believe in climate change? It's essentially like asking, do you believe the weather changes? And yes, the weather changes. It can change in a micro sense or in a macro sense. It can change just in front of our very eyes or in the aggregate over a period of years, centuries, or millennia. I mean, that's just the way it is. It doesn't mean, it has no meaning. It's a meaningless question. It's a meaningless response that you're forced to give. But what they really mean by that, and what they're really trying to do, is to force you into a position where you think, well, because there's climate change, I have to support all these efforts now. I have to support all these policies that will address climate change. And what's interesting is the moment you point out that, well, you know, some of these policies are actually a really bad idea, then you're immediately considered a denier, right? Even though saying that you believe in climate change is not the same as saying you believe that it is a catastrophic threat to the world and we should put all of our resources into dealing with it. That's not the same thing. Not at all, but they try to make it the same thing. When you look at what the proposals are for dealing with climate change from the U.S. side of things, we might change global temperature over the next 100 years if we do everything they want us to do that the real climate change diehards believe in. You might change temperature by 0.1 degree, something like that, 0.2 degrees. This is not particularly relevant. This doesn't really matter. But you could, as a result of trying to do this, trying to change global temperature by that small amount, you could have a major impact on various industries. You could put some industries out of business. You could hurt our productivity, all kinds of issues and problems. President Obama loves all this stuff. He's really excited to try to enact as much climate change, not legislation, of course, but climate change executive action as he possibly can. This is the New York Times today. President Obama's most far-reaching regulation to slow climate change will have its first day in court today, the beginning of what is expected to be a multi-year legal battle over the policy that Mr. Obama hopes to leave as his signature environmental achievement. This has to do with, well, I'll just keep reading you a little bit more of this. In two separate but related cases, the country's two largest coal companies, along with 14 coal-producing states, have challenged a proposed EPA regulation, which the agency issued under the authority of the Clean Air Act, to curb planet-warming carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. If put in effect, as EPA officials have proposed, the rule is intended to fundamentally transform the nation's power sector, shuttering hundreds of coal plants and expanding renewable energy sources such as wind and solar. It's supposed to, quote, fundamentally transform the nation's power sector, shuttering hundreds of coal plants. This brings me back. Do you remember that soundbite that was a taste of so much to come when Obama said that energy prices would necessarily skyrocket? Remember that? He said this. And now we know that he really meant it. We were told, oh, no, he was just talking and, you know, people say stuff, politicians and, you know, hope and change and all that stuff. But he said that this is what he's going to do. And now he's doing it. And we're going to have to live with this. And especially for some of the eastern states, this is a huge deal because they get a lot of their electricity from coal. And coal is actually a very, very efficient, at least economically efficient source of power. And this means higher energy bills in your homes. It means higher costs for goods and services in stores. It means higher production and manufacturing costs. It's just a giant tax on all of us. And the president is desperate to push this thing through. It is absolutely insane. This will mean nothing. This will mean nothing in terms of saving the planet or protecting us or keeping our air clean or any of the rest of it. But it does tie into, to bring us back sort of full circle here, to the ultimate goal of all this. The ultimate goal of a lot of this climate change research stuff really comes down to, or not research, climate change policy stuff, comes down to a statement of who some people think they are, how wonderful they are, how brilliant they are. It is moral and political exhibitionism on display. because it's so divorced from any other, you know, and any other policy dispute. Like, you can disagree with people on Obamacare, and at least they'll talk to you about pre-existing conditions. At least they'll talk. At least you can agree that health care costs are out of control. You can reach some points of discussion on these issues without immediately it turning into some kind of a food fight. But I've tried this before on climate change. You can't. People have been brainwashed. They have been completely overtaken with the rhetoric. They've been completely overtaken with the concept that there are smart, good, moral people who believe that climate change is a threat to the planet. And then there are these terrible people that are trying to stop it. Whenever you're forced into that kind of absolutism, bad things result. You know, I was watching a bit of the HBO documentary last night on Scientology. And one of the key concepts that keeps coming up throughout that entire, and I highly recommend you watch it, by the way, is that anyone who's inside, once you buy in to Scientology, because part of it is, and of course, what is it? It's kind of a whole mishmash of crazy, but and they can't even explain it. I can't even really explain it without, it's a religion made up by a science fiction writer who realized that this was a great way to make a lot of money because you could get an IRS exemption, and he ended up floating around on boats to avoid the IRS, and they ended up taking on the IRS and winning and getting the tax exempt status. But anyway, they think they're saving not just the world, but the universe for all eternity. At least that's part of the brainwashing process. And as a result of that, because they believe they're literally saving the world, not in the sense of, like, you know, helping starving children is saving the world, and by that we just mean doing a really good deed. No, no. They think they're actually saving the planet. Now and for all eternity. And if you believe that, what are you not willing to do? If you believe that you are going to save the planet from destruction, where do you draw the line? And I know that you'd say, oh, well, come on, you know, eco-terrorists aren't as bad as jihadists, right? And there are some limitations on this. Sure, but that's because the best way to achieve the goal seems to be to create a false scientific consensus and then have major international institutions and the U.S. government leading the charge with them to put these huge restraints on our productivity, on our freedom, on our way of life, because they're saving the planet. And just the twang of absolutism that surrounds all of the stuff about climate change, and the fact that President Obama is not even trying to do this congressionally, right? That's not even up for discussion, because especially in some of these states where they have a lot of coal plants, they want to protect their Democrat politicians in there for other reasons. So they don't want to force them to take a vote on this issue. And so President Obama is just sort of doing this unilaterally, deciding that the decision was his and is his alone to push forward. And of course, once a power plant is shuttered, it's done, right? You're not going to have these things started back up. And once the price of energy raises dramatically, remember, this is not market driven. This is driven by ideology, by an absolutist ideology that you're saving the planet. By doing this stuff, you're going to prevent really a global meltdown of sorts. And so what are you not willing to do? How many people around the world may actually be dramatically affected by some of these moves and regulations? What are the changes that are going to happen to food productivity and just to economies around the world? You know, in some places, a bad economy means people starve. But don't worry about it. The president's got a much bigger issue at hand, and that's, of course, his legacy. And his legacy is saving the planet. It's really ridiculous when you think about it, but this is the stuff that they're doing, everybody. Democrat Party. But they care about the middle class. They want their electricity bills to be really high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team Buck, I don't spend a lot of time here talking to you about marijuana legalization because I know that I think a fair amount of you are probably pretty indifferent to it. Although, actually, I don't know now that I think about it because we don't talk about it that much. So maybe you have very different views on this than I'm assuming. But nonetheless, it is an issue it is an issue that is well worth our discussion right now, because I think it'll play into what's going to happen with some of the candidates, because you have a couple of states here that have legalized marijuana. As I said, I actually went to a screening of a CNN documentary series on this called High Profits. And they were showing us the earliest days of legal marijuana in Colorado, and how this is obviously going to be a huge industry and a big business. And they estimate billions of dollars are in play here for the legal marijuana industry. But I take it back a little bit from there, right? I look at this also on just the issue of whether or not this should have ever been treated as a Schedule I drug. Now, yesterday, a federal judge decided that she would not remove marijuana from the list of the most dangerous drugs. Understand this. I think few people actually know this, and it's important if we're going to talk about this, especially as whether you care about marijuana or not, as an issue of the states as laboratories that can exist outside of complete federal government control all the time. Marijuana is one of the first times we've seen states in a long time just sort of openly defy criminal law, because they are going to. And the federal government has backed off on this because they see the politics of it. And I think they see where the trend is going. But marijuana is treated the same way, in at least broadly speaking. I mean, different places have additional penalties. And understand this, too. It's illegal under federal law. It's also legal under, it has been illegal under state laws. You know, there's all these different intersecting laws on drugs. And while you can be dealt with at the local level for drug offenses, you always could be, conceivably at least, prosecuted federally as well, because it's a federal crime to have these drugs, which is also insane. As I've also said before, it is a federal felony to sell prescription drugs to somebody, controlled substance prescription. I mean, I don't think they're going to charge anyone for under a felony for selling penicillin, but maybe, I don't know. DEA is pretty bored sometimes. But they treat marijuana the same way that they treat heroin and cocaine and these other substances. They are Schedule I prohibited substances. And finally, now people are starting to say, this is crazy. But this federal judge said, well, it's up to Congress to decide to change the law, which is true. But then it's up to us to discuss the fact that the notion of this being a Schedule I substance is just completely insane, right? I mean, if you're going to whether you think it should be legal or not, and I know some of you probably think that it's bad for your communities and there's any number, and I would have a discussion with you over, well, does the prohibition of marijuana actually work or function in any meaningful way, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whether you think that it should or should not be legal, the punishments are outrageous for it. The punishments are much more severe than I think any rational argument would lead them to be. And that's something that we should probably start to address and be more serious about. I don't understand why people seem to think that possession of marijuana should be treated as some heinous crime. Not heinous crime, but serious crime. Because it's just not. Underage drinking. We don't encourage that. And I think the drinking age should be 18. And I have never heard of it has to do with highway fatalities. People drink underage, overage, it's going to be highway fatalities. You know, there's certain dangers in life. And I think if you're old enough to vote and to serve your country and risk your life for your country, you are certainly old enough to buy a beer at a corner store. It's just a dumb law. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just the hysterics out there who seem to think that by legislating these kinds of things excessively, we're going to get better outcomes for society. It's just not, it's not proven by the facts, and it's not logical. But if you get caught underage drinking, as many of my friends have when I was younger, obviously, if you get caught underage drinking, it's not a big deal. You know, maybe in Amherst, they actually would lock you up for the night, which I thought was really, really nasty. They would arrest you. You had to walk across. There was a street that was a town street. And if you walked across it with a plastic cup. And I always thought that this was unreasonable search and seizure, by the way, because you just have a cup. How do they know what's in the cup? You know, they would say, oh, it's open container law. It's a local thing, right? It's open container. And they have that so that kids can't just walk around, you know, college kids can't just walk around drinking whatever they want. But if they caught you with your red Solo cup, the mark of all college parties, apparently, it's like the one ubiquitous item that all college parties have, they would actually lock you up overnight for it. But you knew that your life wasn't ruined. You knew that you weren't, a criminal. You weren't going to not be able to get a job because you were caught crossing the street with beer illegally. But if you get caught with weed, in some places, that's a big problem. And that's in part from the fact that the federal government in the 1970s, with the Controlled Substances Act, decided to start treating marijuana as though it were in any way akin to heroin or cocaine, drugs that are physically very addictive. And this is not, now we're just going hashtag science, drugs that are very addictive, and also drugs where overdose is a very real possibility and people die from them. And the health risks, immediate health risks. People say, oh, marijuana is bad for you. Yeah, well, so is smoking. The immediate health risks of some of those other drugs is very different. But to treat all these drugs like they're the same, I mean, to suggest that, you know, selling an OxyContin is the same as selling heroin is the same as selling crocodile or meth is just completely irrational. But we've created this huge law enforcement complex that all it has to find ways to justify budgets and all this personnel and all this paperwork. And they're always on the lookout for drugs, trying to find more people who are guilty of drug possession. And I just think that we've seen where this goes. I don't think that it doesn't work. All the statistics show that, you know, marijuana, it's not like they're going to get rid of marijuana usage in this country anytime soon. In fact, now it's very likely to be legal. And in fact, I would like to see, and maybe we've just sort of stumbled into this now, I would like to see the Republican candidate, whoever it is, suggest that there is a decriminalization at the federal level of marijuana. Let states and localities, if they want to, you know, regulate it like they do everything else, and they want to put restrictions on outside smoking, and they want to put restrictions on who you can sell to, you can't sell it to minors, et cetera, fine. We have all that with alcohol, and I don't think anybody needs a long explanation of the dangers and the societal ills that can come from excessive alcohol consumption. But people say, well, Buck, are you for heroin legalization or are you for cocaine legalization? I said, well, can we talk about marijuana first? How about that? And stop acting like they're the same thing, because they are just not. Cigarettes are not the same as cocaine. Addictive substances are not all the same. And I will tell you now, in all honesty, I may have a slight caffeine addiction. I love coffee. I love coffee probably more than I should. But I don't think anyone thinks that because I drink 2 cups of coffee today a day, there's a big problem. Maybe it's more like 3 cups. But I don't think anybody thinks that that's a big issue, right? We can understand that there are different substances that have effect on the body that can range from minor to catastrophic. And if you're going to sort of legislate for public safety purposes as well as individual safety purposes, we should all at least look at these things for what they are and not cave into sort of the fear mongering about this stuff. And I'm telling you this, and I'm somebody who doesn't touch marijuana, has no interest in any legal drugs, honestly, and couldn't for years and years as a matter of my profession because I was in the intelligence community and had a security clearance. So I couldn't go near any of that. So I would have been fired, terminated immediately, right? And now maybe you could say, well, I'm just an old grumpy man. I always forget their names. The Muppets from the Balcony. What are their names? Oh, I love those guys, but I forget their names. Whatever, I'm Sam the Eagle, whatever it may be. And so that's why I don't like that stuff now. That all may be true, but the point I'm making here is simply that I just wish there was a more honest discussion about what it would really mean and what's really happening. And it all really also comes from a place of, and I have friends, by the way, who would have been great agents, great CIA officers. I understand it's different on the law enforcement side, because if you've been guilty of crimes, then you're going to be enforcing crimes. Looks a little weird for an FBI agent to be locking somebody away for drugs when he himself was selling drugs in college, for example. But I have friends who were barred from government service or couldn't get a security clearance because they got caught with a little weed when they were in college or something like that. I mean, it's just, for what? And then it maybe shows up even on their record, and now they might have to explain it at a job interview. You know, what are we trying to do here exactly? And look, I know some of you probably disagree with me on this, and that's fine, but I just want to air this out. This is where, and people say this is where the libertarian in some of us really just gets a little preachy, but it's true. And I think of people in poor communities who are selling drugs as a means of trying to make some money for themselves. And I don't think that that's, this is another thing, by the way, socially, you start to see there are some people who can talk about how they sold very hard drugs, celebrities even. And I don't think they were making distinctions about who they were selling it to. I hate to break that to everybody. But, you know, selling crack is very different from selling marijuana. And there are some very famous people in this country right now who have sold crack and who have sold cocaine. And they are treated like the elites of society now, even though I think at one point in time, very obviously, they were making very immoral and very destructive choices and harming people's lives in very dramatic ways. But, you know, you sell a little weed, I think you should get a second chance. I don't think you should be locked away. I don't think that your life should be ruined. I don't think your record should be full of this. And, you know, we're also a society that increasingly has to come to grips with there's no starting over. Right. I mean, your record now follows you. Your record is instantaneously accessible to everybody. Your record is with you always and everywhere. I mean, your record is Google, but your record is also whatever criminally pops up during a background check or anything else. And all employers want to do these sorts of things now. That's what's happening. So we need to start being a little bit more, I think, a little bit more forgiving in what essentially puts someone on a path to being completely unable to chase their dreams, to be productive, to live as free citizens for minor stuff. And it's embarrassing. I mean, it's embarrassing for me. I'll be honest with you, sitting around when I talk to people about this, and there a lot. I hear people are very preachy on this, and I can tell you that there's. I know law enforcement guys who are locking people up for stuff that they themselves in the past have done in terms of smoking marijuana or even be selling a little to their friends. It's just out of control. Anyway, this federal judge did not decide to take it off. Does not. Push to remove it as a Schedule I drug, and I understand why. It's up to the Congress to do it, but Congress is a bunch of wimps. And by the way, they're the problem more than the IRS, as much as we were beating up on the IRS a couple of days ago. The truth is that they're the enforcers, but Congress are the mafia bosses here. They're the ones that are actually sending out the enforcers. The enforcers are the IRS. And I'm just, so far, I think the Republican Congress is pitiful. I haven't done anything, nothing to get me excited about anything, not making me more free, not letting me keep more of my money. They're a joke. That's why I don't spend too much time here talking about politics. I don't want to make us all depressed. All right, taking a break, back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at TheBlaze.com.
Go to TheBlaze.com/shop. T-shirts there. You know what? Tomorrow we should give out a couple of T-shirts. We should light up the lines a bit on our Freestyle Friday. You know, before we close today, I saw this thing about the guy who landed his gyrocopter on, what was it, on the lawn of the White House? No, on the lawn of the Capitol building. I'm sorry. On the lawn of the Capitol building, rather. And this guy is a 250-pound ultralight gyroplane. It was piloted by a 61-year-old mailman from Florida who was en route. He released some letter, which is now, you can see this. I'm seeing this on myfoxtampabay.com. He was had 535 letters to deliver to all members of Congress. And he was, interestingly enough, he was upset about money in politics and corruption. He writes in this letter, "You may pretend corruption does not exist. You may pretend to oppose corruption while you sabotage reform. You may actively participate in real reform. If you're considering option one, you may wonder if voters really know what the chase for money is. Your dismal and declining popularity documented by Gallup suggests we know, but allow a few examples, by no means a complete list." Blah, blah. Okay, he goes on. You know, as much as I think that it's a really bad idea to fly a gyrocopter close to, as much as I think that's a really bad idea, because he almost, they've now said, was shot out of the sky with long guns of, I guess, either Capitol Police or whoever's, who's ever closest to this thing. Not a good idea, very unsafe. He said that he was willing to risk life and limb in order to get his message across, and he certainly was. But you can kind of understand a little bit of the sense of, well, helplessness to actually get Congress to do anything worthwhile and good. And also, I have to say, this guy kind of managed to get his point across. He's probably also going to spend some time in prison now. But he got his point across. And he's making stuff. He got national attention for himself here by pushing these letters out to Congress via gyrocopter. At least that's what he says he's going to do. You know, we got to give the guy points for ingenuity, I guess. He didn't hurt anyone, I don't think, right? There were no injuries here. Not a smart move, though. It is interesting to see, though, how close you could get in a sort of aerial vehicle to the Capitol building, apparently. This is now something that it's only a matter of time, I think, before there's some nefarious intent that arises with the use of this stuff. But, you know, sometimes I guess you just put together a gyrocopter and want to make a splash, and that's what this guy did. Whatever. All right, Team Buck, tomorrow we're going to have a Freestyle Friday. I'm going to be thinking about it all night so we can have fun tomorrow. In the meantime, go to Facebook.com/BuckSexton. Check out BuckSexton.com. Give me your email address there. Jay Severin up next. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining. Always a pleasure, my friends. No matter what happens, shields high.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.